Hello, this is Beth Ludwig from Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall share with you information from the September issue of Ladies' Home Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Our first article is called That Little Voice Inside Your Head by Dan Ferber. Something was wrong with her daughter, and Jennifer McConnelly knew it. Kia should have been recovering from her cold, but the seven-month-old was still crying and wheezing. She wasn't acting right, and she wasn't breathing right, says McConnell, 23, of Toledo, Ohio. So on a frigid February night, she grabbed her baby and raced to the nearest hospital. She sounds clear as a bell, said the doctor who examined Kia. Dismissing McConnie's concern, the baby's noisy breathing was from her stuffy nose, the doctor said, but McConnie was not sure. In my heart, I just knew there was something wrong with her, she recalls. Frightened for her daughter, she sped across town to another hospital. I'm not leaving until you tell me what's wrong with my baby, she demanded. McConnie's gut feeling was right on the money. Kia was, in fact, dangerously ill. A blood test revealed a potentially deadly respiratory infection, and the baby had pneumonia. A pediatrician and three nurses hooked Kia up to monitors, administered IV antibiotics, and kept close watch. By the next morning, Kia's blood oxygen levels slowly began to climb, and her heart rate stabilized. A few days later, McConnie took her baby home, grateful she had trusted her intuition. It may seem like a magical power, but intuition actually springs from observation and experiences, explains cognitive psychologist Gary Klein, author of The Power of Intuition. While you consciously think of other things, your unconscious mind is recording your experience, including tiny details you may not realize you're noticing. When you use your intuition, you're actually using all the information, Klein says. The reason it seems so mysterious is that it's subtle, complex level of knowledge that you generally can't articulate, the way you couldn't tell someone else how to recognize your old high school buddy in a crowd. Jennifer McConnie wasn't a doctor, but she knew her daughter. She couldn't tell the physician what seemed wrong, but her unconscious mind was well aware of warning signs so subtle that even pediatric experts missed them. Intuition is a powerful brain function, and as McConnie discovered, not to be ignored. In fact, one psychological study after another has shown that intuition can outperform the careful decision-making of the conscious mind. You recognize your intuition at work when you have strong gut feelings, as McConnie did. But your unconscious, intuitive mind helps you out on a daily basis, too. Have you ever found yourself so wrapped up in thought while driving that you're not sure how you got home or why you didn't end up in an accident? Your intuition was at the wheel, explains psychologist David Myers, author of Intuition, Its Powers and Perils. Research psychologists have learned in recent years that the unconscious part of the mind not only takes on a situation, but sets goals, as in turn left at the next stoplight, and responds even when your conscious mind isn't paying attention. Similarly, the intuitive mind of a skilled violin player allows her to place the bow at the correct angle and slide it across the strings automatically. In that sense, intuition is kind of like autopilot, except it only works when you have enough relevant experience. Those automatic responses are based on years of practice. An amateur violinist would have to concentrate on using the right bow angle. And if you'd been that distracted while driving when you first got your license at 16, your unconscious mind wouldn't have been able to save you, and you probably would have gotten in an accident. One Saturday night several years ago, Deborah wanted to go out dancing. It was out of character for the divorced mom of three. I'm not one for bars. It's really not my scene, she says. Nevertheless, the watered-down Ontario resident, then 42, called a girlfriend, and they headed out on the town. At a local dance club, she spotted a tall blonde man. He smiled at her and she felt immediate connection. He walked over and asked her to dance. Afterwards, they chatted. Deborah, who now coaches business executives on how to develop their intuition, had been writing a speech about the call of destiny. When she told this to the man, Jim, he told her he was such a firm believer in fate that he tattooed the Japanese character for destiny on his shoulder. They talked for hours, and Deborah suggested he come to her presentation. He showed up, they started dating, and 7 years later, they're still together. How did Deborah know at a glance they had so much in common? It may have been luck, Klein says, but Deborah could have also been picking up on subtle body language, a certain type of gaze, a way of dressing or standing that reminded her of other men in the past that she had connected with. Those qualities we noticed but can't necessarily articulate can be crucially important. Research by the University of Virginia psychology professor Timothy Wilson has shown that a couple's gut feelings about each other predict whether or not they'll stay together much better than their list of pros and cons about the relationship. Of all our intuitive thoughts, the ones about other people are among the most accurate, says Myers. The unconscious mind, like the conscious one, learns from experience, and gut feelings about people draw on a lifetime of social interaction. For example, we're very skilled at reading emotions and faces. We can tell if someone's happy or anxious almost immediately. This is a type of intuition at which women excel, says psychologist Judith Hall of Northeastern University. Both sexes do equally well on tests of some types of social intuition, such as telling when someone is lying. But hundreds of studies have shown that women are better than men, on average, at grasping the emotions and personality of others based on brief video clips or face-to-face interactions. Her team recently dug deeper to try to find out the specifics that give women the intuitive advantage. They discovered that women are better than men at noticing and remembering when people frown, shrug, lick their lips, talk with their hands, or communicate in other nonverbal ways. In Hall's opinion, this is a learned skill rather than a hardwire advantage. Women are trained their whole lives to be interested in people's feelings, she says. Girls are encouraged to express their emotions and to recognize and respond to the feelings of others. By the time they are grown, they have mastered the nuances of emotions and body language in a way that men, trained from boyhood to brush it off, often focus on action. They have not learned this skill. The good news is, whether you're male or female, you can improve your intuition and learn to be more perceptive. Despite the remarkable power of intuition, sometimes it does fail. Love at first sight sometimes ends in divorce. Investors trust hunches and keep buying a stock long after they should have dumped it. Intuition often gets confused with impulse, Klein says. Intuition can go awry if several elements of something you recognize, but not all, are present in a situation. He likens this to a smoke detector designed to react to smoke particles in the air being set off by a construction dust. The particles are there, but they aren't smoke, and there's definitely no fire. Your intuition can make the same kind of mistake. For example, you might intuitively distrust someone who has the same mannerism as a person with whom you had a bad experience, even though they don't share any of the other qualities. You need to balance intuition with analysis, experts agree. Stop and think. What is my judgment based on? Says cognitive psychologist Michael Young of Southern Illinois University. Do I have the right information and experience? If the answer is no, you're probably acting on impulse, not intuition. Even if you do have reason to trust your gut, it's still not a bad idea to stay skeptical. Pay attention to anything that contradicts your gut feeling, and recognize that intuition may be specific to one area and not another. For example, Young says, if you're making a hiring decision, you may have accurately intuitive that a candidate is a nice person and fun to have lunch with. But without a lot of hiring experience and sufficient data, your good feeling about the candidate may have absolutely no relation to her ability to do a job well. Intuition is clearly flawed, but so is analysis. You need both to make best decisions, experts say. If Jennifer McConney had blindly trusted the first doctor's analysis of her daughter's health, Kia might not have made it. But she needed the second medical team in order to get proper treatment. While McConney is grateful to the hospital staff that saved her daughter, she says she also learned a valuable lesson. If my gut tells me something, I'm listening to it. Here's tips from the author on honing your hunches. Intuition can be learned, and it can pay off by helping you make better decisions. Here's how to improve yours. First, relax. Although intuitive mind is always working, you'll hear it best when you're relaxed. Meditate if that's to your liking, or just get comfortable. Close your eyes and take a few deep breaths. Next, ask a question. Open-ended questions work best, says Lynn Robinson, author of Trust Your Gut. For example, instead of asking yourself whether you should take a particular job, ask, what should I do to make more money? Your intuition might come up with possibilities you aren't consciously aware of. Give it time. Intuition doesn't give the answers immediately. Instead, it may come when you least expect it, such as when you're taking a shower or walking the dog, and even when you're daydreaming. Get advice. Cross-check your intuition with facts. Romance is a classic example. If all your friends, brothers, sisters, and parents are telling you this is not a good relationship for you, you probably should listen. And last, practice. Pay close attention to nonverbal communication and listen to what your gut is telling you. When you make a mistake, analyze it to find the red flags you missed so you'll be aware of them next time. Intuition is a skill like any other skill. The more you practice it, the better you get at it. Our next article is called Love Story by Margaret Wrinkle. My husband Haywood and I were taking dinner to some friends with a new baby when their toddler climbed up on the sofa and announced, "I sing you." We had no children of our own yet, but we knew enough to understand that little Becca was tired of having people fuss over her new brother. So we sat down on the floor and settled in to hear this tiny child sing an adorable rendition of Kinkle Kinkle Little Star, complete with wiggling fingers for every twinkle of the star. When she finished, I pulled Becca into my lap. Haywood leaned over to me and whispered, "Let's have one of those." I shouldn't have been surprised. We've been married 2 years by then and pushing 30. We both had good jobs teaching high school English. On paper, we were certainly ready to have a baby, but I had my doubts. If you're already living a full life, do you willingly give up some of that fulfillment to make time for a howling, time-devouring infant? We hardly had time for each other, much less a baby. In addition to 7 hours each day at school, there were also 3 hours of after-school coaching, plus papers to grade, long novels to read, lessons to plan, and tests to write. Plus, we both had friends we wanted to spend time with. Often, there were days and days in a row when we didn't lay eyes on each other until we fell into bed at night. I could find no evidence that Haywood was prepared to cut back on his intricate lesson plans and his golf games. And I had to admit that I wasn't prepared to give up anything either. So I just kept saying, "I don't think we're ready." Then I got pregnant. It happened the way these things tend to. In a moment of failed vigilance, single, oh, what the moment, seizure of love on a sunny afternoon with the smell of cut grass and the sounds of the birds, after 3 weeks of worrying, 2 home pregnancy tests, and a trip to the doctor, I suddenly understood that my life had changed forever. But I wasn't thinking that I had been handed a gift. All I could sense was a fading ghost of my freedom. I didn't share the news with Haywood for the first 3 days. My deepest instinct was to see this calamity as a thing that happened to me, only to me. I was the one already feeling vaguely unsettled at the scent of scrambled eggs. I'm not sure even now why I waited so long to tell him. Finally, on the third night, I wrote a note on the flyleaf of a collection of children's poems I had bought for the child of a long-distance friend and never had found the time to mail. For Haywood, to read aloud, beginning in 9 months. I left the book on the bathroom sink for him to find when he got home. When he climbed into bed, he reached for me in the dark and whispered, "Margaret." I fell into his arms and sobbed. As filled with anxiety and despair as I felt, Haywood was filled with equal amounts of wonder and anticipation. And despite my lingering fear that I would be the one making all the sacrifices over the next 9 months, I began to notice he was nearby a lot more, reading in the living room with me at night instead of holing up in the front of his computer. If I fell asleep on the sofa in the afternoon, I'd wake up to find an Afghan over my legs and the phone unplugged from the wall. When I came home from a long-planned weekend trip to see an old friend, he met me at the airport carrying a homemade box of coupons for back rubs, foot massages, and pledges to cook my favorite meal. The box came with a card. The card said, "Here are a few small things I can do for you while you're doing the biggest thing for us." I began grudgingly and ungracefully to think that maybe this would work out. Maybe our unremarkable little tragedy was actually a romantic comedy in disguise. For as surely as my waist was thickening and my breasts were swelling, as gradually as our little office was being dismantled, a crib taking the computer's place, Haywood and I were changing too, growing closer, growing up. 3 weeks before Sam's due date, I woke up one night with an upset stomach and kept dashing into the bathroom. After my third trip, Haywood suddenly sat up in bed and said, "Is it time?" "It's just a stomach bug," I whispered. 2 trips later, he returned on the light. "You're getting this bug every 5 minutes," he said. "I'm calling the doctor." I said I hadn't felt a single thing that could be considered a contraction, and anyway, first babies were almost always late, but he dialed the number. It turned out Haywood knew I was in labor before I did. While he was still on the phone with the answering service, my water broke. A few hours later, we finally met our beautiful Sam. Before long, I came to think of the night he was born as a microcosm of our lives. Without even realizing it, we had become a team. Haywood and I don't always agree about what's going on with our children, much less what we should do about it, but we figure it out together, as on the night Sam was born. Eventually, it's time to take a child to the emergency room, whether one needs to be grounded, when to encourage, when to step back, and all the other questions that come up for parents of 3 children. Haywood and I were lucky. Instead of driving us further apart, parenthood taught us to love each other in new ways. Watching Haywood become a father was the ultimate aphrodisiac, and not just because he rose to the occasion in every way I suspected he couldn't. It's because he knows me now, and I know him, in a way that goes far beyond our roles as parents. Our youngest child is nearly 10, and Haywood and I have both recovered some of the interest in activities we mostly gave up when the kids were small. But the ways in which parenthood transformed our marriage persist. I always understood from those first darting motions inside me that my children will leave me someday. But I count on, sometimes in the middle of yet another battle over video game privileges, and I dream of a future with Haywood that will last for decades after they've gone. Mary Tillman's Private War. After football star turned Army Ranger, Pat Tillman died in Afghanistan. His mother took on the government to reveal the truth behind his death. This article is by David Hockman. It's one of the defining stories of America's long, heartbreaking war in Afghanistan. Less than a year after 9/11, and shortly after marrying his childhood sweetheart, Pat Tillman, 25, walked away from a multi-million-dollar NFL contract to join the Army's Elite Rangers, along with his younger brother, Kevin. Even though he loved football, Pat didn't want to be part of some superficial game when there were people putting their lives on the line, says his mother, Mary Tillman, whose family saga is the subject of a riveting new documentary, The Tillman Story. I tried talking them out of it, but once I realized that wasn't going to happen, it was important that I support them. During Pat's second tour of duty in April 2004, Mary received the news all military mothers dread. I was at home and got a message to call my daughter-in-law, Marie. I had a bad feeling about it, she says. When I asked her what was going on, she didn't say a word. I asked again, and she was still silent. I got more upset. Then she told me Pat had been killed. Despite Pat's expressed wish not to have a military funeral, the Army gave him a hero's goodbye, complete with a silver star at a public memorial attended by Army brasses and luminaries, like Senator John McCain and California's First Lady, Maria Shriver. The official story was that he died in a firefight with the Taliban as he charged up a hill without regard for his own safety. It turned out to be a sham. 5 weeks later, after several internal investigations, the Army admitted Pat did not go down in a blaze of glory, but was probably killed by friendly fire. I didn't quite believe the original story to begin with, Mary says now. Not that Pat wasn't heroic, he was, but it was a little too pretty, like a movie. Pat was the highest profile soldier they had, she added. They wanted to rally support and make people angry at the enemy. But the Army's new story also raised questions. How did the friendly fire happen? Why wasn't there a criminal investigation immediately after the incident? Mary Tillman went on to spend the next 4 years poring over thousands of military documents for clues. She later chronicled her investigation in her 2008 memoir, Boots on the Ground by Dusk. Working day and night, I don't sleep much, she says, in the Northern California cottage where she raised Pat and his two younger brothers, Richard is the youngest, she did not relent until she got answers. Even though parts of the military files were blacked out, she pieced together what she considered to be evidence of a cover-up. She says Pat's body armor, uniform, and military journal had been burned in breach of protocol in a barrel on his Army base in the middle of the night. According to Mary, documents revealed questionable behavior on part of the platoon soldiers in Pat's unit. The more questions she had. Why had the soldiers fired on her son when they allegedly seen arms waving, another flagrant violation of Army rules? Why did a field hospital report say Pat was transferred to ICU for CPR when in fact he had been shot in the head and died instantly? Such details were chilling and horrifying, Mary says, but what drove her was knowing that Pat himself would have busted down doors to get the truth. Had something happened like this to another family member, he wouldn't have stood for it, she said. Although Mary logged the hours, it was an angry letter to military investigators from her ex-husband Patrick Tillman, a San Jose, California attorney, that eventually led to a congressional hearing. That April 2007, inquiry during which both Mary and her son Kevin, who was discharged a year after Pat's death, testified, accused the military of smoke screening. It led to a second congressional hearing, 4 months later, that focused on an internal memo from Lieutenant General Stanley McChrystal, then commander of a special ops task force in Afghanistan. In a message to other high military ranking personnel written days after Pat's death, McChrystal reportedly warned it might cause public embarrassment if the circumstances of Corporal Tillman's death become public. But in dramatic testimony shown in the documentary, an all-star panel of generals denied any part in the cover-up. Most couldn't even recall receiving McChrystal's memo. Instead, the blame was put mostly on Lieutenant General Philip Kinzinger, a three-star general by then retired, who led the Army's special operations after 9/11. As I said in the second hearing, Mary says, I went from feeling angry to just numb resignation that nothing more was going to be done. No one was going to hold anyone accountable for their actions. Mary says she is done pressing for answers. Pat would have not wanted us to spend our lives doing this, she says. For the past year, she has been a grief counselor at a Catholic cemetery, and she is in touch with other military mothers whose children have died. You realize everybody has their tragedies, and you are not alone, she says. There are still times, of course, I'm very sad, and it hits me just like it did the first time I heard the news, she says. But I'm comfortable by having a sense of who Pat was. He's still vivid in my mind. When I talk about him, it's like he's still around. He makes me appreciate life. To go see a preview of the Tillman Story documentary, you may go to ladieshomejournal.com/Tillman. That's LHJ.com/TILLMAN. It's time for the answer, lady. Questions and answers about manners and morals. Our first question. At our last girls' night, my friend had a bit too much wine and spilled some really personal details about her marriage. Now she's avoiding me. Should I clear the air? Here's the answer. Of course. Without rehashing the gory details, lighten her load by saying, don't tell me you've been avoiding me because of the conversation we had that night where we all had one glass too many. You know what they say. What happens at girls' night stays at girls' night. On the other hand, if you suspect that what you heard was just the tip of the iceberg and she really needs someone to confide in and you're up for it, you could add, you never have to worry about me judging you. So if you need to talk, I'm here for you anytime. Next question. My mom posts photos of my kids on Facebook, and I'm not okay with little girls in their swimsuits. How do I clue her in without scaring her offline? First, educate your mom about privacy settings and make sure she's only sharing it with families and friends. She could be showing the whole world without realizing it. Log in together and show her the options under the account tab. If you prefer those photos not to go out to anyone, try this. Mom, I love that you want to show off the kids, but there are some pictures that make me uncomfortable. I just feel better if we don't put certain kinds of photos out there. Unless your mom was born yesterday, she knows that there are weirdos in cyberspace, and she should be happy to cooperate. Our last question. One of my coworkers brings in really smelly tuna sandwiches for lunch. I know it's none of my business, but it's making me gag. Can I say something? I'm not clear on when and where the aroma is occurring. Is it a storage issue? If her unrefrigerated lunch sits on her desk all morning, the air with the scent of fish, perhaps you could ask her to keep it in the fridge. Don't send out one of those thinly veiled email groups, but polite. Be polite and upfront. I know I'm kind of a wimp, but I'm one of those people who's sensitive to smells. Would you mind keeping your lunch in the kitchen? On the other hand, if the problem occurs at lunchtime, when she's actually eating, you should find someone somewhere else to be at that time. The woman is entitled to eat her tuna in peace. Here are five things we love about the month of September. The first one, September's National Yoga Month. Yes, and it's a real holiday. The Department of Health and Human Services created it to promote health benefits. Well, we've run out of time for today's issue of From Soups to Nuts. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Beth Ludwig, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. So long until next time.